Hello and welcome to today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, January the 15th, 2024. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story. It's entitled, Youth Recognized for Their MLK Tributes. Students' work will be displayed in the children's section at Dubuque's Carnegie Stout Public Library from Tuesday, January 16th through February 4th. It's written by Eric Hogstrom. Bitterly cold temperatures forced organizers of a Dubuque event recognizing Martin Luther King Jr. to cancel a march planned for Sunday, but an allied event recognizing Dubuque students' project inspired by the civil rights leader drew more than 60 people. "We're astounded so many people came out. It's noteworthy," said Donna Lowen of the Dubuque branch of the NAACP. Students and their parents filled pews at St. Luke's United Methodist Church on Sunday afternoon for an event that recognized local youth from kindergarten through high school who had created posters, paintings, a diorama, essays, and slide presentations based on a pair of themes inspired by the life and work of King. Tribute organizers received entries from 426 students. "Every year the variety and creativity seems to expand," Lowen said. Held since 1990, the annual event usually is preceded by a march from Jackson Park. "I canceled the march due to the weather," said Anthony Allen, president of the Dubuque branch of the NAACP. "This is only the second time in the last 10 years we canceled the march. I didn't want to cancel because those that marched in the beginning didn't have the option of canceling, but I also have to consider the safety of the marchers. Instead, individuals braved the cold to come to the church and support their children." Students were called individually to the front of the church, where Lowen asked them to discuss their tribute projects. Maria Chapman, age 11, of Dubuque, created a poster that included details on the life and work of abolitionist and activist Harriet Tubman. "She did the Underground Railroad," said Chapman, a fifth-grade student at Prescott Elementary School. "I would describe her as powerful, brave, and kind." The elementary school theme was kindness, fairness, and friendship. "A second or third grader might think differently than a high schooler, so we always have different themes," Allen said. The high school theme, "Till What End?" asked students to create works devoted to hidden figures who work to eradicate hatred and was inspired by Mamie Till. "She is a hidden figure key to all of our hearts," Allen said. Mamie Till was the mother of Emmett Till, the 14-year-old black teenager murdered in Mississippi in 1955. Mamie Till became a social activist following the death of her son. "She shared the hurt that America should be feeling based on the incident that happened to her son," Allen said. "It took a lot of strength, character, and poise for her to allow America to see that this is what hate does." Allen said participating teachers had students thinking about the King tribute projects in early September. "That allowed for the project to not be a rushed activity," he said. "The kids took a lot of pride in their projects. I learned a lot about hidden figures." Jalen Koenig, age 18, of Dubuque, painted a portrait of LGBTQ+ activist Marsha P. Johnson. "She was a hidden figure, and she wanted equal rights for everybody," said Koenig, a 12th grade student at the Alta Vista campus in Dubuque. Koenig said the project was rewarding. "Painting is a big hobby of mine," she said, "so I was able to do something I enjoy while learning about Johnson." The students' work will be displayed in the children's section at Carnegie Stout Public Library in Dubuque from Tuesday, January the 16th to February the 4th. "It's always a pleasure to honor the children," Allen said, "especially when they do work that is working toward the things we do as an organization. The kids did an excellent job of recognizing what exists today and recognizing what we can be tomorrow." Next is an article entitled, Cuba City Salon Completes Makeover. It's written by Grace Neeland of the Telegraph Herald. The dateline is Cuba City, Wisconsin. When Michelle Custer, planned a total interior remodel of her Cuba City hair salon, there was one item she knew had to remain the same. Everything else was replaced or refurbished, from the floor panels to the repainted, elevated ceiling. Through it all, however, one staple remained, a classic green barber chair that has stood in the shop for decades. I just knew it had to stay, Custer said. It's been here for 50 years, so it's vintage now. Everyone knows that chair. Custer recently completed her renovation of Hometown Hair and Barber at 105 South Main Street after purchasing the business roughly 3 years ago from longtime area barber Joni Von Glahn. Custer since has worked to expand the salon's offerings for Cuba City residents. The salon now offers cut, color, and styling services for women, men, and children, as well as a dedicated area for manicures and nail care. Soon, she also will add an eyelash technician to the team for lash extensions. Small towns deserve nice new things too, Custer said. Sometimes you need to just be able to go down the street for something like this instead of having to drive 30 minutes. Throughout the remodel, Custer said she kept the shop's namesake top of mind. She worked to keep the space homey and inviting, she said, so every client could feel comfortable coming in for their appointment. I want people to come in and feel at home. That's why I named it Hometown Hair, she said. A lot of people think we're still a full-time barbershop, but we have a lot of other services to offer. This fall, she also plans to start an exterior remodel to better match the salon's facade to its current brand and services. Hometown Hair and Barber currently is accepting new clients, Custer said, and the shop can be reached at area code 608-778-3643 or 608-885-0177. The salon is open by appointment from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. Monday and Tuesday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Wednesday and Thursday, 8 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Friday, and 8 a.m. to noon on Saturday. Walk-ins will be accepted as availability allows. Our final story from the front page of the Telegraph Herald is entitled Common Courtesy, a Family Trait for Dubuque Couple. Tom and Sue Riedel were married on November 26, 1965 at Church of the Nativity in Dubuque. This is written by Michelle London, and it's part of the continuing series highlighting tri-state couples married 50-plus years. Tom Riedel and Sue Stitzman, both born and raised in Dubuque, loved going to the teen dances that were held every weekend at Melody Mill when they were young. I would go with my girlfriends, said Sue, now age 77. It was just a fun time. Tom and Sue, who later would become Sue Riedel, didn't know each other. Tom attended Wallert High School and Sue was a student at Academy of the Visitation, but fate brought them together one night when Jerry Lee Lewis was playing at the mill. I was supposed to go to a birthday party, said Tom, now age 79, but I wanted to hear Jerry Lee Lewis play, so I decided to go late to the party so I could see him. As usual, Sue was at the mill that night with her girlfriends, who were on the dance floor. She was sitting alone at a table when Tom noticed her. I decided to ask her to dance, he said. After their dance, Tom asked if he could take Sue home. I said, well, if you do that, you'll have to take my girlfriend too, Sue said, because my parents wouldn't have approved of me being brought home by a boy alone. So Tom took Sue and her friend home to Sue's house after the dance. And then I walked my girlfriend home from my house, Sue said, laughing. Tom didn't leave without Sue's phone number, and he soon called her for their official first date. It happened to be my birthday, Sue said. He took me to Timmerman's Supper Club, and I was really impressed. Tom liked Sue, but was a bit hesitant about asking her out again. I was from the North End, he said, and she was from what we thought was the rich part of town, different worlds. But they kept going out. After about 7 dates, Sue was still waiting for that first kiss. So we were out, and I just said, hey, and gave him a kiss, Sue recalled. Then I said, Pearl Harbor, sneak attack. Tom wasn't sure what to think, though he liked the kiss. At first I thought she was going to say, hey, I got somebody else, he said. Sue said she knew Tom was the guy for her. He was just so nice, and his family was nice, she said. He was kind, and he treated me really well, and he treated his mother so well. Someone always told me to watch how a man treats his mother, because that's how they'll treat you, so I knew he was a good guy. The couple married on November the 26th, 1965, at Church of the Nativity. They have 3 sons, Scott, Brian, and Jason, and 9 grandchildren. They also have 1 great-granddaughter. They recently celebrated their 58th anniversary. Both worked a few other jobs before landing at John Deere Dubuque Works. Tom as a security officer and Sue in the administrative offices. They both had long careers at Deere. Tom retired from his job in security in 2003, after almost 31 years, and Sue retired as the senior accounting clerk in 2001 after 27 years. With Tom working nights and Sue working days, their oldest son, Scott, of Galena, Illinois, said he and his brothers rarely had a babysitter. "We really lucked out there," he said. "Dad would get us off to school when he got home from work. Mom would be there in the evenings. There was always one of them there." Tom and Sue have traveled extensively throughout the U.S., both on their own and with guided tour groups provided through John Deere. They also enjoy a 7-country European vacation with another couple and took the entire family on a Caribbean cruise to celebrate their 40th anniversary. Despite some recent health challenges, they have stayed active with their Nativity Church parish. Sue has served on several committees and held several leadership posts, including president of the parish council. They also belong to an over 60 social group through the church, where they enjoy meeting on occasional evenings for a meal and a game of cards. Tom, who said he got a bit bored after retirement, works part-time a few days a week at the Dodge Street Hy-Vee. "I'm a jack of all trades there," he said. "Whatever they need me to do, I do." Scott said his father relishes the human interaction he gets from his job. "He really doesn't have any hobbies, so it's not like he's out on the golf course or anything," he said. "He gets bored if he doesn't have anything to do. He loves to talk to people, and when he's bagging groceries or whatever it is he's doing, he runs into people he knows all the time." With tongue in cheek, Tom said he knows the secret to their long marriage. "I worked nights and she worked days," he said. "Weekends weren't for fighting, they were for being with each other." Sue said common courtesy has always been a part of their relationship, and Scott said it is an attribute that has carried down to him and his brothers. "They're always thinking of each other," he said. "My dad loves the candy circus peanuts. Whenever I see them, I think of him and pick them up. It's something I always do for my wife, too." His parents are pleased to know that quality was passed down to their sons. When your spouse does something for you, you should say please or thank you the same way you would for anyone else, Sue said. You're out somewhere and you say, "Oh, there's his favorite candy bar. I'll pick one up." It lets them know you're thinking of them. It's the little common courtesies and little surprises that make it special. From the Dubuque and Tri-State page, Illinois lawmakers representing Joe Davies County look to tackle budget migrant services. This is written by Elizabeth Kelsey, and the dateline is Galena, Illinois. Illinois lawmakers representing Joe Davies County look to hold the line on state spending and address the state's increasing migrant population, among other topics, as the Illinois General Assembly convenes this week. The state legislative session begins Tuesday, January 16th. Illinois Senator Andrew Chesney, a Republican from Freeport, said he considers it the legislature's first duty to pass a responsible budget, something he feels the Democratic majority has not yet done in the 5 years he has served in the General Assembly. "Republicans are going to continue to demand budget restraints and budget discipline," Chesney said. "We saw an increase in revenues due to hyperinflation, but we are now anticipating revenue flattenings and reductions, so we need to have a serious conversation about the priorities of our budget." Illinois Representative and House Republican Leader Tony McCombie, a Republican from Savannah, agreed that fiscal responsibility is top of mind for her as the session begins. She also plans to propose a bill to address what she sees as deficiencies in a new law that took effect January 1st and requires employers to offer 40 hours of paid leave to full-time employees who have worked for them for at least 3 months. "That policy is going to be pretty detrimental to small businesses, nonprofits, and municipalities that employ, for example, students," she said. "There's some fixes that are needed." Chesney also expects the legislature to have serious and robust debate about the state's recent influx of migrants and the services those individuals receive, particularly health care. More than 30,000 asylum seekers from the U.S.'s southern border have arrived in Illinois since August of 2022, according to the state's website. Since 2020, Illinois has offered state-funded health care coverage to low-income individuals age 65 and older, regardless of immigration status. The program was expanded to cover those aged 42 to 64 in 2022. However, the state paused enrollment in the program last year. The health care we provide for migrants and illegal immigrants is the best health care in the state, better than that of virtually every citizen who resides here legally, Chesney said. Republicans and Democrats are far apart on this issue. Since it is a presidential election year, both Chesney and McCombie said they expect the legislative session to be quieter than normal in terms of the number of controversial bills proposed, at least until after Illinois' March primary. Both acknowledged that as Democrats control both legislative chambers and both the governor's office and hold the governor's office, the party will set the tone for the session. Our ability to change the law is very difficult, but that doesn't mean we won't continue to try, Chesney said. We have to generate policy that works for everyone. Officials with the Illinois Democratic Party and Joe Davies County Democrats, as well as the office of Illinois House of Speaker Emmanuel Chris Welch, a Democrat from Hillside, did not respond to requests for comment. Under the news in brief heading, police say man assaults bouncer, sending him to hospital. Police said a man assaulted a bouncer at a Dubuque bar, sending the bar employee to a hospital. Dante R. Bartman, age 22, of Dyersville, Iowa, was arrested at 1:23 a.m. Sunday in the 100 block of Main Street on charges of willful injury causing serious injury, possession of marijuana, and public intoxication. Court documents state that Bartman assaulted James E. Finn, age 20, a bouncer at Mason Dixon Saloon, at approximately 12:46 a.m. Sunday in the basement of the bar. Finn was transported to a hospital for treatment of a laceration below his right eyebrow and a swollen right eye, documents state. The cut above his eye required several stitches to close, documents state. Finn's right eye was swollen shut, distorting his vision. Police observed a large amount of blood and numerous blood drops in the basement and leading up the stairs toward the rear exit where Finn was found, documents state. Surveillance footage from the bar shows Finn approaching Bartman and directing him away from the bar in the basement, documents state. Bartman can then be seen punching Finn repeatedly with a closed fist, documents state. Longtime former Hills and Dales CEO dies. The former longtime CEO of a local nonprofit serving people with disabilities died recently. Marilyn Althoff, age 66, of Earlville, Iowa, died at home Friday following a battle with ALS, her obituary states. Althoff served as CEO of Dubuque nonprofit Hills and Dales from 2004 until her retirement in 2021. The scope of the nonprofit serving people with disabilities expanded greatly during her years as CEO, more than tripling in service offerings and clients supported, according to a statement from Hills and Dales leadership issued following her death. Althoff spent a total of 32 years working for Hills and Dales. Our mission today cannot be understood independent from Maryland's ardent leadership and impact, reads the statement from the nonprofit's board of directors and current CEO, Jack Mesher. We are saddened at her departure from this world and feel only gratitude for the many years of her life she gave to this mission. And the Dubuque Police and Dubuque County Sheriff's Departments reported Marquise L. Logan, age 25, of 2130 Woodland Drive, number 4, was arrested at 3:14 a.m. Sunday at his residence on charges of domestic assault, second offense, interference with official acts, and obstruction of emergency communication. And Barak Y. Carroll, Jr., age 28, of 2643 Queen Street, was arrested at 9:04 a.m. Saturday at his residence on a charge of domestic assault with injury. Next is an article entitled, Principal Injured in Iowa High School Shooting Dies, Had Jackson County Ties, by Scott McFetridge and Tricia Ahmed of the Associated Press. Dateline is Des Moines, Iowa. An Iowa principal who put himself in harm's way to protect students during a school shooting earlier this month died Sunday, a funeral home confirmed. Caldwell Parish Funeral Home and Crematory confirmed the death of Perry High School Principal Dan Marburg after the family announced it on a GoFundMe page. Marburger was critically injured during the January 4th attack, which began in the school's cafeteria as students were gathering for breakfast before class. An 11-year-old middle school student was killed in the shooting, and six other people were injured. The 17-year-old student who opened fire also died of an apparent self-inflicted gunshot. The day after the shooting, the State Department of Public Safety said Marburger acted selflessly and placed himself in harm's way in an apparent effort to protect his students. News of Marburger's death first were posted on a GoFundMe page for his family. The post by Marburger's wife, Elizabeth, said he died at about 8 a.m. Sunday and said, "Dan lost his battle. He fought hard and gave us 10 days that we will treasure forever." The news that Marburger died triggered a flood of support on the Perry Facebook page, with nearly 200 people posting condolences within the first hour after it was posted. Iowa Republican Governor Kim Reynolds offered her condolences. "Our entire state is devastated by the news of Dan Marburger's death," she said in a statement Sunday. "Dan courageously put himself in harm's way to protect his students and ultimately gave his own life to save them. He will forever be remembered for his selfless and heroic actions. May he rest in peace." Reynolds ordered all flags in Iowa to be lowered to half staff on Sunday and to remain that way until sunset on the day of Marburger's funeral and interment. In a Facebook post on the night of the shooting, the principal's daughter, Claire Marburger, called her father a gentle giant and said it wasn't surprising that her father tried to protect his students. "As I heard of a gunman, I instantly had a feeling my dad would be a victim, as he would put himself in harm's way for the benefit of the kids and his staff," his daughter wrote. "That's just dad." Marburger had been principal since 1995. He also had ties to Jackson County, growing up in Cibola, graduating from East Central High School, a now-closed school in Miles, in 1985, and returning to teach and coach at the school for a few years before moving to Perry. An 11-year-old sixth grader, Amir Jalif, was killed in the shooting. Authorities said he was shot three times. The shooting happened just after 7:30 a.m. January the 4th, shortly before classes were set to begin on the first day back after winter break. Authorities said the suspect, identified as Dylan Butler, had a pump-action shotgun and a small-caliber handgun. Mort Vett told the Associated Press authorities also found a pretty rudimentary improvised explosive device in Butler's belongings and that experts advised it was something that they needed to disarm. It was rendered safe. The GoFundMe page for Marburger was further updated on Sunday. "All of the Marburger family and the entire Perry community will forever be touched by the selflessness of Mr. Marburger. This GoFundMe will continue to be used for the Marburger family as they process through and live out Dan's legacy," it said. In tri-state news, Wisconsin Conservation Group gets state grant. A Southwest Wisconsin group has received a state grant to support farmer participation in efforts to improve the state's soil health and water quality. The Lafayette Ag Stewardship Alliance received a grant of $29,600 from the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, according to a press release. The release states that the Lafayette County Group is one of 47 receiving funding in the ninth round of grant awards since funding first was made available in the 2015 through 2017 biennial budget. Grant projects focus on providing conservation education to farmers, conducting on-farm demonstrations and research, issuing incentive payments for implementing conservation practices, organizing field days, and gathering data on soil health and water quality. Dubuque Museum plans Valentine's Day dinner. A Dubuque museum will host a Valentine's Day dinner next month. The event will be held from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. February 14th at National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium, 350 East 3rd Street, according to an online announcement. The event features a five-course plated dinner with an appetizer, soup, salad, entree, and dessert. The cost is $60 per person, and payment is due at the time of reservation. Registration is available by calling Terry Witt at 563-581-4986 or emailing Terry, T-E-R-I, at rivermuseum.org. Registration closes February the 2nd. Visit rivermuseum.org/events for more information. Now we turn to the opinion page, and first we have an other view written by Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune, which is entitled, When DEI Spells Opportunity for All, It's Not So Scary. Why is DEI upsetting so many people when so few people seem to know what the heck it really is? Such is the confusion I perceive in the dialogue that two well-known rich guys who love to tweet recently had with each other on X, formerly Twitter. Tesla CEO Elon Musk poked Dallas Mavericks minority owner Mark Cuban earlier this month as the two got into a tweet spat over the hot-button issue of diversity, equity, and inclusion, known as DEI for short in the business world. Musk got things going on his X platform by writing that DEI was just another word for racism and shame on anyone who uses it. Cuban responded with a string of tweets praising DEI. These are the same people that work for you or are your coworkers, he wrote. Everyone is entitled to their point of view, but these same feelings, even if they are not said out loud, are heard loud and clear at work. Musk responded with a snippy reference to the makeup of Cuban's Mavericks. Cool, he said. So when should we expect to see a short white/Asian woman on the Mavs? Ho ho. Cuban didn't immediately respond to Musk's reply, which is an old anti-affirmative action joke, old enough to have whiskers on it. But in a serious debate discussion, he could have said something about efforts by the National Basketball Association and other professional sports teams executives to improve their embarrassingly low numbers of black head coaches, a long-running gripe among black athletes and many of us who root for them. The reality is that the NBA and other pro sports teams have taken steps to improve racial diversity at all levels for good business and public relations reasons, they say. Unfortunately, that optimistic take runs counter to the latest wave of ideological battles to hit the elite university campuses in an escalating culture war just in time for a new election year. The recent resignation of Harvard's first black president, Claudine Gay, opened a new front in the culture war that conservatives have waged against what they see as liberal academic wokeness. This is the beginning of the end for DEI in America's institutions, said conservative activist Christopher Rufo, a pioneering leader in the crusade against critical race theory, an academic framework which is not taught in public schools, although you would never guess it from the fuss that Rufo and his allies have stirred up. Have they now brought an early end to DEI, as Rufo claims? That would be easier to believe if so many of the critics and, for that matter, more than a few of the DEI supporters I have heard sounded a little more like they knew what they were talking about. By the way, what is DEI? That's a good question. Like critical race theory, DEI has become another example of a phrase or acronym popularized by progressives, then hijacked by the right to make it sound downright sinister. That's politics. We saw similar demonization of diversity policies in the 1960s when the right condemned even the Civil Rights Act's protections of equal justice under law as reverse consideration and the like. Yet, I understand the opposition felt by many Americans on the right, left, and wobbly middle to ideas or programs that tried to promise not only equal opportunity, but equal results. Progressives of that extreme strain unwittingly are the best allies the right could ever ask for. I think the late King of Soul, James Brown, had it right in his underappreciated ditty on the flip side of his 1960s hit, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Just open up the door. I'll get it myself. It's a hip tune, as we used to say. And you can dance to it. You are listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Our second opinion piece today is entitled Dr. King Continues to Inspire Us. It's written by James Patterson, who has written more than 200 novels since 1976. He has had more than 114 New York Times best-selling novels and holds the New York Times record for most number one New York Times bestsellers by a single author. His novels account for 1 in 17, or roughly 6%, of all hardcover novels sold in the United States. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would have been 95 years old this year. Tragically, he was assassinated in Memphis in 1968. Today, January 15th, Dr. King's birthday, is a federal holiday to remember the importance of his life and service. The King Holiday and Service Act of 1994 created the Martin Luther King Jr. Day of Service. It encourages Americans to volunteer to address community issues such as educational disparities, hunger, and homelessness. Dr. King ministered not only to his church congregation, but to a nation hurting due to the evil of segregation. Dr. King's campaign to end segregation continues to inspire people around the world. Segregation was so oppressive that blacks could be arrested for entering a public library to borrow a book or for drinking from a public white-only water fountain. By his marches, rallies, church gatherings, and boycotts, Dr. King remained dedicated to ending segregation. He never let fear distract him from his mission. My favorite quote from Dr. King is, "The function of education is to teach one to think intensively and to think critically. Intelligence plus character, that is the goal of true education." Segregated school systems failed all students. Dr. King recognized that when segregation fell, public education would improve. He believed that improved educational systems would improve understanding between the races. In the historic 1954 Supreme Court decision ending school segregation, Chief Justice Earl Warren said that segregation was psychologically harmful to black students. "It affects their hearts and minds in a way unlikely ever to be undone," he said. Some psychologists of the era believed that segregation was demoralizing to whites, too. Sadly, many U.S. school systems continued to enforce segregation for years after the Supreme Court decision. In some Alabama school districts, segregation continued until the early 1970s. In the mid-1970s, Georgia Governor Jimmy Carter worked to end segregation in his state's 159 counties. In 1963, popular psychologist and syndicated columnist Dr. Joyce Brothers wrote a column where she identified six ways segregation harmed white kids. She said that segregation could cause white kids to lose respect for authority figures and experience repressed guilt, among other things. Segregation might also create awkward professional relationships in workplaces. Brothers broadened the concerns expressed in 1954 by Chief Justice Warren. She believed that segregation was psychologically damaging to all students. In the excellent book Combined Destinies, Whites and Blacks Confronting Racism, psychotherapists Ann Todd Jealous and Caroline T. Haskell edited stories from individuals who expressed remorse for behaviors such as unearned privilege that might have arisen due to segregation's lasting effect on them and their families. It is worthwhile to read and study the courageous personal accounts in this brief 197-page book. While the psychological damage of segregation might be long-lasting, the healing power of Dr. King's lessons, sermons, and life experience is also long-lasting. Church services offer an opportunity to reflect on Dr. King's work. Libraries, museums, and schools are other places that offer programs designed for the King holiday. Community food banks offer rewarding volunteer opportunities. Celebrate the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. holiday with family and friends. It is a time to rejoice with one another on the progress made to create a spirit of unity and forgiveness across the nation. Today's only obituary is for Marilyn R. Althoff, who we spoke of earlier. Marilyn Rose Althoff, age 66, of Earlville, passed away peacefully on Friday, January the 12th, 2024, after a hard-fought battle with ALS. She was in her home surrounded by her loving family. Visitation will be held from 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. on Wednesday, January the 17th, 2024, at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. Visitation will continue at the funeral home from 9 to 10 a.m. Thursday, prior to funeral mass. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, January the 18th, 2024, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Earlville, with burial in the church cemetery. Reverend Chris Podhaski will officiate, with Deacon Jim Steger assisting. To recognize her life's work, memorials may be sent to Hills and Dales, 1011 Davis Street, Dubuque, Iowa, 52001, or www.hillsdales.org. Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville is assisting the family, and information is available at www.kramerfuneral.com. Memorials may be sent to the family in care of Kramer Funeral Home, 750 12th Avenue Southwest, Dyersville, Iowa, 52040. We have a number of funeral services. First, John E. Bartles of Anadarko, Oklahoma. Visitation 9 to 10:30 a.m. Friday, January 19th at Cranmer Funeral Home in Dyersville. Service 11 a.m. Friday at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville. Joyce E. Coleman of Dubuque. Visitation 1 to 4 p.m. today at Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper's Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 John F. Kennedy Road. Shirley I. Dack of Dubuque, Celebration of Life, 1 to 6 p.m. with a time for sharing from 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Saturday, January the 20th at Happy's Place. Jerome H. Feldman of Dyersville, Iowa. Visitation 9 to 10 a.m. today, Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville. Mass of Christian burial 10:30 a.m. today at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville. Lois George of Dubuque, Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. today, Holy Trinity Catholic Church. Charles E. Hawkins of Cascade, Iowa, visitation after 9 a.m. today at Rife Funeral Home, Cascade, Iowa. Service at 10:30 a.m. today, Cascade Community Presbyterian Church. Christopher J. Hermson of Janesville, Wisconsin. Visitation 9 to noon, Saturday, January the 20th, Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Lancaster. Service noon, Saturday at the funeral home. Euleen M. Hutchcroft, Lamont, Iowa. Visitation 9 to 11 a.m., Wednesday, January the 17th, St. Joseph Key West Catholic Church. Mass of Christian burial, 11 a.m., Wednesday at the church. Noel Kurt of Dubuque, visitation 3 to 7 p.m. Thursday, January the 18th at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. Mass of Christian burial 10 a.m. Friday, January the 19th at Holy Trinity Catholic Church. Jeanette E. Loffenberg, Dubuque, visitation 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, January the 16th, St. Anthony Catholic Church. Service 10:30 a.m. Tuesday at the church. Mary K. Lawrence of Benton, Wisconsin. Visitation 3 to 7 p.m. Thursday, January the 18th at Hawden Shield Funeral Home and Cremation Services, Cuba City, Wisconsin, and 9 to 11 a.m. Friday, January the 19th, St. Patrick's Catholic Church, Benton, Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m. Friday at the church. Linda Martins, Cambridge, Illinois. Visitation 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Wednesday, January the 17th Hackerman Meyer Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Bellevue, Iowa. Service 12:30 p.m. Wednesday at the funeral home. Jeffrey S. Peffley, Dubuque. Visitation 10 to 11:45 a.m. today at Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Streets. Service noon today at the funeral home. Lila A. Feiler of Richardsville, Iowa. Prayer service 3 p.m. today, Kramer Funeral Home, Holy Cross. Visitation following prayer service until 8 p.m. today and 9 to 10 a.m. Tuesday, January the 16th at the funeral home. Service 10:30 a.m. Tuesday at Holy Cross Catholic Church. David J. Robb of Dubuque. Visitation 10 a.m. to noon today, Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. Service noon today at the funeral home. Joseph E. Rand of Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. Visitation 9:30 to 11 a.m. today, St. Peter Evangelical Lutheran Church, Prairie du Chien. Service 11 a.m. today at the church. Marie T. Recker of Manchester, Iowa. Visitation 10 to 10:45 a.m. today, St. Mary Catholic Church, Manchester. Mass of Christian Burial 11 a.m. today at the church. Peter Roth of Dubuque. Visitation 9 to 10:15 a.m. today, Holy Ghost Catholic Church. Mass of Christian Burial 10:30 a.m. today at the church. James M. Sheehy, Cascade, Iowa. Visitation 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. today, Rife Funeral Home, Dyersville. Mass of Christian Burial 2 p.m. today, St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville. Charles E. Sieverding of Dubuque, visitation 9 to 10:30 a.m. Thursday, January the 18th at Hackman Meyer Funeral Home and Cremation, service Bellevue, Iowa. Service at 11 a.m. Thursday, St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Bellevue. And Sarah E. Smith of Dubuque, visitation 8:30 to 11 a.m. Saturday, January the 27th, St. Anthony's Catholic Church. Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m., January 27th, at the church. Now we turn to the sports page, and we'll start with some local sports. Central knocks off Dubuque men. Caleb Brand dropped 25 points, and Grant Johnson contributed 22 points as Central College upended Dubuque 85-75 in American Rivers Conference men's basketball in Pella, Iowa. The Spartans lost for the second straight time after a 13-0 start to the season. Sam Kilberg led Dubuque with 21 points, while Tatum Arguello added 18 points. Brock Simon had 11 points, and Dylan Anderson recorded a double-double with 10 points and 10 rebounds. The Dutch took a 45-36 lead at the intermission. Dubuque, ranked number 18 in the NCAA Division III, suffered its first loss of the season Wednesday at Coe. The Spartans will play city rival Loras on Wednesday night. In women's college basketball, Dubuque 53, Central 52 at Pella, Iowa. Tabria Thomas scored 18 points on 8-for-14 shooting from the field and 2-for-4 shooting from the free throw line to lead the Spartans. Megan Teal added 8 points and 6 rebounds, while Thomas and Morgan Hawkins each had 6 boards. Isabella Tierney's 3-pointer with 2 minutes and 1 second remaining in regulation accounted for the final margin. Central's Samantha Scott missed a tray at the final buzzer. In men's college hockey, Concordia of Wisconsin 3, Dubuque 2 at Mequon, Wisconsin. Alex Ochichitwa scored in the final minute of regulation to lead Concordia to the win. Max Erstad and Josh King scored goals for Dubuque, which earned the first win in program history on Saturday and is 1-13-2. Chris Kerr made 49 saves for the Spartans. And women's college hockey, Concordia of Wisconsin 5, Dubuque 2 at I'm On Arena. Lauren Jeffrey scored a power play goal, and Cassidy Bessia added a shorthander for Dubuque, but Concordia responded with the final 4 goals of the game to win. The teams will meet again at 2:30 p.m. today. Here's what sports are on television today. First up, for men's college basketball, we've got Ohio State at Michigan at 11 a.m. on Fox. George Mason at George Washington at 1 p.m. on CBS Sports Network. Villanova at Marquette, 1:30 p.m. on Fox. LaSalle at St. Joseph's, 3 p.m. on CBS Sports Network. Iowa at Minnesota, 5 p.m. on Big Ten Network. Notre Dame at Boston College, 6 p.m. on ESPNU. American University at Loyola, Maryland, 6 p.m. on CBS Sports Network. North Carolina A&T at Hampton at 8 p.m. on the CBS Sports Network. In NBA basketball, the Spurs at the Hawks at 2:30 p.m. on TNT, and the Warriors at the Grizzlies at 5 p.m. on TNT, and then the Bulls at the Cavaliers, 6 p.m. on the NBC Sports Channel Chicago. NFL postseason football, you got the Steelers at the Bills at 3:30 p.m. today on CBS, and the Eagles at the Buccaneers at 7:15 p.m. on ESPN. In the National Hockey League, we've got the Islanders at the Wild at 5 p.m. on BSW, which I think is Bally Sports Wisconsin. In NFL news, wild card stunner. Last team in NFC playoffs, Packers, upset Dallas in opening round. Jordan Love threw for 3 touchdowns. Aaron Jones ran for 3 more. Darnell Savage returned an interception 64 yards for a score. And the Green Bay Packers handed the Dallas Cowboys their first home loss since the 2022 opener in a 48-32 wild card stunner Sunday. Romeo Doubs had a career-high 151 yards receiving a week after being hospitalized with a chest injury as the Packers won Love's postseason debut after finishing the regular season with 6 wins and 2 losses to grab the NFC's final playoff spot. "We came in here with the mindset of we're going to dominate," Love said. "A lot of people were counting us out, and we didn't care about that." Green Bay, with a record of 10-8, will visit top-seeded San Francisco in the divisional round next weekend. Dak Prescott threw 2 interceptions before 3 mostly empty touchdown passes in another playoff flop for him and the number 2 seed Cowboys, whose record was 12-6. Dallas had won its previous 16 regular season home games, but now has allowed the most points in a game in the club's postseason history. The previous high was 38. The Cowboys, who haven't reached an NFC championship since the most recent of their 5 Super Bowl titles 28 years ago, didn't trail by more than 8 points at AT&T Stadium this season before falling behind 27-0 in the first half. The loss will raise questions about the future of Dallas coach Mike McCarthy after the Cowboys lost their playoff opener at home for the second time in 3 postseasons under the former Green Bay coach. Dallas is the first team to win at least 12 games in 3 consecutive playoff seasons without making a conference title game. "Just shocked, honestly," Prescott said. "From the beginning of the game, we got beat. There's no which way around it. There's no way to sugarcoat it. Shock." The Packers have never lost in 6 trips to AT&T Stadium, including the Super Bowl over Pittsburgh during the 2010 season. They now have 2 playoff victories over the Cowboys after Aaron Rodgers led a 34-31 divisional title when Dallas was the NFC's top seed in 2016, Prescott's rookie year. Those Packers let a 21-3 lead slip away. These Packers, with the 4-time MVP's successor, left little doubt with a 48-16 fourth quarter lead before 2 late Dallas TDs. "We knew it would take time," Jones said. "You would hear me during the season and other players say, we were right there, we're right there, we're right there. We've been able to get over that hump." Facing the NFL's 5th best defense, Green Bay matched its Super Bowl winning team from 2010 for the most points in a playoff game. That was also on the road, a 48-21 victory at top-seeded Atlanta in the divisional round. And in another NFL playoff game, Chiefs power through. Mahomes heats up despite sub-zero temps in Kansas City. It was so cold that Patrick Mahomes' helmet shattered on a hit. Andy Reid's mustache froze on the sideline. Fans and players alike huddled for warmth, trying their best to grit their way through the fourth coldest game in NFL history. The Kansas City Chiefs managed to handle the adversity well Saturday night, handled the Miami Dolphins quite well, too. Mahomes threw for 262 yards, found Rashee Rice 8 times for 130 yards and a touchdown, and made several daring runs for key first downs. Isaiah Pacheco pounded over the frozen turf for 89 yards and another score, and the Chiefs shut down a prolific Miami offense in a 26-7 victory in the wildcard round of the playoffs. Harrison Butker added 4 field goals for the reigning Super Bowl champs, who appear to be warming up for another run. "Guys came with that attitude, that mentality. We knew it was going to be cold," Mahomes said. "All week we were preaching, let's come in there with that fire and just get after it and see what happens." Meanwhile, the injury-depleted Dolphins looked nothing like the same dynamic offense that led the league in yards. Tua Tagovailoa was pressured relentlessly by the NFL's second-ranked defense. Wide receiver Tyreek Hill had a 53-yard touchdown catch, but was otherwise shut down in his return to Kansas City, and the Dolphins finished with 264 yards in all. They have not won at Arrowhead Stadium since November the 6th of 2011, nor won a playoff game since December 30th, 2000. Losing is never fun, and when the stakes are higher, when it's playoff time, you feel that maybe 10 times more, said Tagovailoa, who was just 20 of 39 for 199 yards passing with an interception. "We've got to live with that loss." The Chiefs get to live with another win in their 15th consecutive home playoff game, not counting a trio of Super Bowls that netted them 2 Lombardi trophies. But they will head to Buffalo next week if the Bills beat the Steelers on Monday in a game pushed back a day by a blizzard. Otherwise, the Chiefs will host Houston, which beat the Browns earlier Saturday. "Everybody was out there playing for each other," Rice said. "We just put the weather to the side and knew that our opponent didn't want to be out there just as much as we didn't, and we showed our love for the game." It was -4 degrees Fahrenheit at kickoff, easily setting a record for the coldest game at Arrowhead Stadium. But it was wind gusts whipping through at more than 25 miles per hour and driving the wind chill to a bone-rattling -27 degrees that made the weather truly miserable for just about everyone. That included pop star Taylor Swift, who once again turned up to see her boyfriend, Chiefs tight end Travis Kelce. She at least got to watch from an enclosed suite. Most fans bundled up outside in parkas, ski goggles, and snow pants, and players huddled around heaters on the sidelines as if they were oases in the cold. The National Weather Service even issued a warning for what it called dangerously cold weather that had blanketed the Midwest. In fact, the cold may have made Mahomes' helmet brittle enough that a hit in the third quarter knocked a chunk of the plastic shell from it. Once officials saw the fist-sized hole, they made Mahomes get a backup helmet from the bench. "We have to talk about where we store the backup," Mahomes said with a smile. "It was like frozen." The weather didn't seem to bother Hill, who was playing in Kansas City for the first time since his old team traded him to Miami 2 years ago. The league's leading receiver warmed up in a short-sleeved shirt, then proceeded to scorch the stout Chiefs defense and all-pro cornerback Trent McDuffie for a long touchdown reception midway through the first half. "It's where it all started for me," Hill said afterward. "Just being back on the field brought back so many memories." The Dolphins otherwise struggled on offense, though, just as they did in a 21-14 loss to the Chiefs in November in Germany. They were just 1-for-12 on third down, and they never put together a truly sustained drive until the fourth quarter. "We knew they were going to put a lot of attention toward our receivers," Dolphin coach Mike Daniels said. "We thought we had the right plan, and obviously it wasn't, and hats off to them for executing their plan in the most important time." On offense, the Chiefs scored on 4 of their first 6 first-half drives. Mahomes capped the first with his touchdown toss to Rice, and while ensuing drives continually fizzled in the red zone, Butker added a trio of field goals to help Kansas City forge a 16-3 lead. The Chiefs added another field goal in the third quarter, but it was still a two-possession game in the fourth when Dolphins appeared to force another field goal, but a late flag on Christian Wilkins for roughing the passer on third down gave Kansas City a fresh set of downs, and Pacheco plowed into the end zone moments later to give the Chiefs a 26-7 lead. The Dolphins never threatened down the stretch in their 11th straight loss when game time temps are 40 degrees or less, far less in this case. And from the Sports in Brief, Harbaugh expected to meet with Chargers next week. The Jim Harbaugh Derby for the NFL teams is about to heat up. A week after leading the University of Michigan to a national title for the college football playoff, Harbaugh will meet with the Los Angeles Chargers about their head coach vacancy this week, a person familiar with the situation told the Associated Press. Besides the Chargers, Atlanta, Carolina, Las Vegas, Seattle, Tennessee, and Washington have openings. Harbaugh, who previously coached in the NFL, has a prior relationship with the Chargers and the Spanos family that owns it. He played for the Bolts in 1999 through 2000 before retiring after the 2001 season. The Chargers are looking for a new coach and general manager after Brandon Staley and Tom Telesco were fired on December the 15th, a day after a 63-21 loss to Las Vegas to the Raiders. Harbaugh has spent the last week decompressing after the Wolverines beat Washington 34-13 last Monday. Michigan held a parade and ceremony to celebrate its national title on Saturday. The 60-year-old Harbaugh has been at Michigan for 9 seasons and has an 86-25 record. Harbaugh's tenure at his alma mater is longer than most people expected when he was hired in 2015. He was at San Diego University for 3 seasons, Stanford for 4, and the San Francisco 49ers for 4. Harbaugh was offered a 10-year, $125 million contract by Michigan that included a clause that he could not entertain NFL's offers this off-season. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.